Thanks for taking the time to listen to this weekly sermon from Southside Baptist Church in Florence, South Carolina. Our vision is to know God and to make Him known, and we now offer two services on Sundays. Our classic service begins at 9 a.m., and our modern service begins at 11:15 a.m., and it's also streamed on Facebook Live. Please visit our website at southsidenow.church so you can find out more about how we are helping make and grow disciples in the Florence area. For now, sit back and take in today's message from God's Word.
All right, in your Bibles, if you'll go to Esther chapter 2, if you would. You know, our history books are full of courageous people who were willing to do what was right in the face of adversity. They use adversity as a stepping stone or fuel to fuel their fire towards the mission that they had in mind. And today I want to mention some ladies that, especially ladies here this morning, that had a great impact. That's had a great impact. And there's more than just what I'm going to mention. But here's some women who made a difference throughout our history. One is Margaret Thatcher. British Prime Minister during the 1980s, developed a close relationship with Ronald Reagan. She was known for her strong and controversial leadership style. Then there's Mother Teresa, who was a nun and charity worker. Mother Teresa dedicated her life to serving the poor, serving the disadvantaged. There's Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat, which led to significant civil rights legislation. There's Anne Frank, who we are familiar with her diary during the time of the Nazi occupation. And she documented her life hiding in the Amsterdam attic during that time of Nazi rule, and died in a concentration camp. Then there's a lady named Florence Nightingale, who lived from 1820 to 1910. What's the big deal about someone named Florence Nightingale? She was a British nurse, born in Italy, who helped improve standards of hospitals and nursing during one of a war called the Crimean War. There's also a lady named by the name of Clara Barton. Growing up, she did not have the same childhood as many other people because she ended up taking care of her brother during a lifelong illness that he had. And she was working at the U.S. Patent Office when the Civil War began. And when it began, like many women, she helped collect bandages and much-needed supplies. But she soon realized that the best support, way to support the troops, was by going in person to the battlefields. And throughout many major battles of the war, she nursed, comforted, and cooked for the wounded, earning the nickname Angel of the Battlefield. And while visiting Europe, she worked with the International Red Cross. And there she became familiar with the Switzerland-based Red Cross, which called for international agreement to protect the sick and wounded during wartime. And so what did she do? She came here and started the American Red Cross. She saw a need. She saw something important. The lady we're going to look at here today is by the name of Esther. In fact, Queen Esther. Someone who God used in a mighty way. Someone who used the wisdom that God had given her. She was a woman of courage and willingness to do what was right in the face of adversity. Her story all started with one day when King Xerxes, who was the great Persian king. Persia was a world power during that time. It was a superpower and of that day. And he also was, because of their country, they had and attained great wealth. Well, as custom, they would have a party. They would have a party before they would go to war. Now, this was not a finger food type party with some cheap wine or bubbly. No, no, no. They partied for 180 days before they went out to war. Now, that is a party, right? I mean, some of y'all went to some fall festivals. We had a trunk or treat here, and we had fun. Maybe went to some other parties, like for like a couple hours, right? No, they partied for 180 days. Half of the year, they partied. Now, these just weren't simple parties. I don't know. King Xerxes was over 127 provinces, basically the known Mediterranean of that day. It was a huge area in which he ruled. And at this party, they put on the Ritz. They really did. They really did. They had gold and silver couches. Man, how would you like a gold or silver couch? What does that even look like? I don't know. I mean, can you imagine sitting in a silver or gold couch and like, oh man, I got silver and gold all over me. Someone needs to clean this thing. I'll do it. Right. But their pavement, even in their pavement, they had these beautiful designs, and that included mother of pearl, and it included marble and costly stones. Drinks were served with gold goblets. They were so rich that the men would decorate their beards in precious gemstones. Man, I mean, they had some money. Could you imagine Paul having gemstones because he was so rich in his beard? Now you're visualizing it, right? Or someone that you think with a large beard. I'm thinking like, you know, probably some relatives of mine, like rednecks, right? They got the beard, the big beard thing going, and they put some, I think they do something for Christmas with that, right? I think you can buy some beard ornaments. I'm sure it's not the same thing in which they were using. But my point is, these parties were a way for the king to show off his wealth. This is where it all started. The custom of that time was to have a party for the women, and there would be a party for the men. And at this party for the men, you would have some of the military, most of the military officials, they would plan. They would plan during this time. And they, of course, the wine and would be flowing. It was unlimited drinking at these parties. And so many of the men were half drunk or completely drunk as they planned their military endeavors. Xerxes, being half drunk, decides he wants to show off his beautiful wife, Vashti, which was against Persian custom. She refused. He was furious. He is prepping to invade Greece. He has all these important military officials from all over his land, and to see his power, to see his wealth, to see his authority. And if he has his queen, if he has his queen, and he shows that he has no authority over his wife, his military credibility would be damaged. Plus, he was used to getting to what he wanted, and she was not interested in listening, in the coming over to be shown off. See, though there was only one queen, he had a harem. He had many concubines. He had many wives, but there was only one queen. And this queen was always one that would be his favorite, that had favor in his eyes. And being foolish, being half drunk, he banishes her. The thing with the law of the Medes and Persians is that once they made a law, it was done. They could not decree. It was done. They could not go back and change it. And so him in his drunken stupor and consulting the men who were around him, his council, so to speak, they said, you got to cut this one off. You got to let her go. And so that's what he does. He regrets it the next morning when he sobers up. He thinks, man, what have I done? What have I done? And so he gets some advice. It's time to look for another queen. And so here we are in Esther chapter 2 and verse 1. It says, but after Xerxes' anger has subsided, he began thinking about Vashti and what he had done and the decree in which he had made. And so the personal attendant suggested, let us search the empire to find a beautiful young virgin for the king, and let the king appoint agents in each province to bring these beautiful women into a royal harem of the fortress of Susa. And Hegai, the king's eunuch, in charge of the harem, will see to it that they are all given beauty treatments. After that, the young women who most pleases the king will be made queen instead of Vashti. And this advice was very appealing to the king, so he put the plan into effect. Kind of like that show, The Bachelor. Now, I won't ask any of you to watch The Bachelor. I'm going to confess some of my sin here. I've watched one season of The Bachelor, all right? Don't hold it against me. I was young. All right. So when I was in college, I think it was like the second Bachelor season, there was a guy from Springfield, Missouri, which we were, there in going to college there in Springfield, Missouri. And so I got hooked in, right? And it's like one of those soap operas. Once you start watching a soap opera, it can just hook you in. I've not gotten hooked on any soap operas, all right? No rumors there. But I watched that season of The Bachelor, and once you get halfway, it's like, well, I'm already halfway here. I might as well just stay in for the long haul here and let this thing finish out. Some of you probably love The Bachelor. It's wonderful. Good for you. Not my cup of tea. But everyone makes mistakes, right? I mean, we're human. We're not perfect. I'm just joking around a little bit. If you watch that, I really don't care. And so, of course, in The Bachelor, or Bachelorette, whatever they call it now, whatever's going on, they hand that rose. I hand this rose to you, or they say something of that sort. And that you, this is what we have going on. We basically have the king having his folks look for another queen. And so they're calling through. They're seeing who are the young virgins, who are the beautiful ones that would fit the taste of the king. And we have maybe the first bachelor going on right here. They're looking and go through. And so at the same time of all this going on, the same time, there's a man by the name of Mordecai who was a Jew. He had a beautiful cousin he had adopted named Esther. They were a part of the Jews who were exiled by Babylon. She was chosen to be a part of this search. And she, I guess you could say, she received the rose. Mordecai told her, keep your Jewish roots on the DL. Don't let anyone else know, because there's folks here who do not look favorably on us. And so the young women, they went through 12 months of beauty treatments and also learning the customs. Let's face it, ladies, let me ask you, how many of you would love to have 12 months of just being pampered? Yeah. Mrs. Littlehand went right up. I'm all for that right there. My wife would too. That sounds good. And once this new queen, though, once she would be chosen, she would spend a night with the king, and then she would go to where they had a second harem, and she would stay there. And if she would only go to the king and only be seen by the king unless the king asked for her, and she found favor in the king's sight. So there may be months, there may be even years that goes by that the king has nothing to do with his queen and even some of the ladies who are in his harem. That's where we pick up at. So the rest of Esther chapter 2 and verse 16, it reads, "And Esther was taken to King Xerxes at the royal palace in early winter of the seventh year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than any other young women. And he was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti. To celebrate the occasion, he gave a great banquet in Esther's honor for all the nobles and officials, declaring a public holiday for the providence and giving generous gifts to everyone. And even after all, the young women had been transferred to the second harem, and Mordecai had become a palace official. He became a gatekeeper, all right? That's what he's doing. Esther continued to keep her family background and nationality a secret. She was still following Mordecai's directions, just as she did when she lived in his home. But one day, two eunuchs who worked closely with the king had a burr in their saddle. They had an issue. They had an issue with the king. And so they start the plot about killing the king. Well, at this time, they're going by the gate, and Mordecai, one of the gatekeepers, is there. He overhears these men planning on killing the king. He reports it to Esther. Esther tells the king and gives Mordecai credit. And what would happen is they would write down, and they're what they call the chronicles, the things that happened during the reign of King Xerxes. They would have their book, they would have it all set up, and they would write about who did what. And so it was written down to what Mordecai had done for the king. And usually, they would be rewarded for what they'd done. Sometime later, though, a man named Haman came onto the scene. And he was appointed by the king to be an important official. When the people would pass by, Haman expected them to bow down to them. And here's the interesting thing about Haman. Haman ultimately came from a group of people called the Amalekites. And with the Amalekites, God had told them, had told the nation of Israel, he had told King Saul, if you remember King Saul, the first king of Israel, to take out the Amalekites. But he did not. He disobeyed. He partially obeyed. It's interesting that because of the disobedience of King Saul and the Jewish people of not destroying a certain group of people who were the mortal enemies of Israel, and it ends up coming back to bite them decades or centuries even later. And so Haman, he had somehow earned this trust of the king. The king, in fact, had given him his signet ring. And the signet ring was just that. I mean, you're probably familiar with it, that back in that day when they would seal a letter, there would be wax, and they would stamp it with the king's signature, basically, of his signet ring. Well, that ring was given to Haman. He had trusted Haman that much. Haman, wanting to destroy the Jews, hating the Jews. In fact, he hated Mordecai. And so when people would pass by Haman, he expected them to bow down. But there was a man who would not. He would not bow down. He would not, in fact, show respect to Haman. And that was Mordecai. Mordecai was going to obey the Lord. Mordecai wasn't going to bow down and worship anything else other than the Lord. That's what he was going to do. On Haman, he'd probably been raised hating Jews. And here's Mordecai, his new target. So Haman, he approaches the king. He tells the king, and the king Xerxes, and their land is so large, it's so huge that there's no way that you can know the details of everything going on in your kingdom. So what did he do? He delegated. He had different men and councils that were over different sections, and so it was very organized. And Haman comes to him and says, "There's a group of people that refuse to obey your laws. It is in your best interest, that we wipe these people out. In fact, I believe so much that we should do this. Here are 10,000 large stacks of silver to pay for it." The king's like, "Man, all right, I don't even have to pay for this. You take that money and you go ahead and take care of business." And so we see what happens here in Esther 3 and verse 12. So on April 17th, the king's secretaries were summoned. And a decree was written exactly as Haman dictated. It was sent to the king's highest officials, the governors in respective provinces, and the nobles of each of the provinces of their own scripts and languages. The decree was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring. Dispatches were sent off by swift messengers and to all the provinces of the empire, giving order that all the Jews, young and old, including women and children, must be killed, slaughtered, and annihilated on a single day. And that was scheduled to happen March 7th of the next year. Notice this. The property of the Jews would be given to those who killed them. There's confusion in the land. People are mourning and weeping and crying. When Mordecai hears of this, just as in biblical times, he tears his clothes, he puts on burlap, and he mourns. Esther tries to send him new clothes, and he refuses. He wants nothing to do with that. He is mourning. He is hurt. He wonders, what is going on? What is God doing? So Mordecai, he's still communicating with Esther. Not directly, but through different servants. And it says in verse 10, "Then Esther told Hathach, to go back and relay this message to Mordecai. All the king's officials and even the people of the provinces know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless the king holds out his golden scepter. And the king has not called for me to come to him for 30 days. Mordecai is telling her, Esther, you've got to do something. Esther, you need to convince the king. Esther, you need to talk to the king. And she simply says, I haven't seen the king in a while. I don't know if he's angry with her. I don't know. It doesn't say. Maybe he's just busy. But she hasn't been called. She would be risking her life just to go before the king in his court unannounced. He would have a choice to make. The king, to whether to raise his golden scepter and to give the okay for her to come in or not. So it continues. So Hathach gave Esther's message to Mordecai. Mordecai sends a reply to her. Don't think for a moment. Don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace, you will escape all the Jews being killed. If you keep quiet, at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place. But you and your relatives will die. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen for such a time as this. She listens. And Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go and gather together all the Jews of Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will do the same. And then, though it is against the law, I will go and see the king. I love her reply. If I must die, I must die. And so Mordecai went away, did everything as Esther had ordered him. So for 3 days, they pray. For 3 days, she risked her life. And she's praying about what she should do. And so after the 3 days are up, after she has fasted, after she had prayed, she had gone before the Lord. She decides to put on her royal robe to enter the inner court to see if the king would raise his golden scepter. And she, thankfully, the king sees beautiful Esther and raises his golden scepter. He has favor with Esther. God has given Esther favor with the king. And she comes and the king asks, What can I do for you? You could tell he loves Esther because he ends up saying, Esther, I will give you even up to half the kingdom. He knows this is important. Why is she coming? Why does she risk her life? It speaks something to him. She says to the king, if I can have, I have prepared a banquet for you and Haman, for me to speak with you. And so they go to this banquet. They go to this banquet. And I think she was simply seeing if a time of testing to see, not just to ask for something right away because she hadn't seen the king, but just to have a banquet, just to see him because of who he was and because she loved him. And there at that banquet, she says, I have prepared another banquet. If it pleases the king to come, have you and Haman come to this next banquet I will have tomorrow. And so Haman is on cloud nine. Man, Haman goes home and he's telling his wife, he's telling his kids, he's telling his council, man, I am great. I am great. Other than the king, I'm second in command, and I'm going to a banquet with the king and the queen. I mean, he is just on cloud nine. He's so much on cloud nine that he says, you know what? And his wife suggests this. I'm going to build a sharpened pole 75 feet, and I'm going to impale Mordecai on that thing. Now, when you read certain versions, some of it says gallows, which we think gallows. We think, you know, hanging them. And but in reality, it's probably more of an accurate translation is of a sharpened pole that they would put them on. The Persians were known for that. Now, whether that was this is a true 75-foot pole or it was just something that was on top of a building that made it 75 feet, I don't know. The purpose was to make sure everyone saw who was hanging on that pole. So he erects this pole. All at the same time. At the same time of this going on, there's no coincidence, is there? There's not. This is not a coincidence. At the same time, the same evening that this pole was erected, that night the king has trouble sleeping. He has trouble sleeping. And so he has one of his assistants, his attendant, bring in the book of history of his reign. And the attendant starts to read it to him. And he starts to read about the story about how Mordecai reported from his beautiful king, Esther, about how the two guys had plotted to kill him. And he's like, attendant, does it say that we rewarded Mordecai? No, we didn't do anything for him. Man, he saved my life. We should do something for him. And while that attendant is finishing his sentences and reading to the king, the king kind of sees a shadow in his inner court. Man, who in the world, who is that? And notice with me chapter 6 and verse 4. He says, who is that in the outer court? And the king inquired, as it happened, Haman has just arrived in the outer court of the palace to ask the king to impale Mordecai on a pole that had been prepared. So the attendants replied to the king, Haman is out in the court. Bring him in. And the king ordered, so Haman came in and said, the king said to him, what should I do to honor a man who truly pleases me? And Haman thought of himself. He thought of himself. Whom would the king wish to honor more than me? So he replied, if the king wishes to honor someone, he should bring out one of the king's royal robes, as well as a horse that the king himself has ridden, one of the royal emblem on his to be put on his head. Let the robes of the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials, and let him see that the man whom the king wishes to honor is dressed in the king's robes, and led to the city square on the king's horse, and have the official shout out as they go. Oh, this is good. This is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. Notice verse 10. Excellent! The king said to Haman, quick, take your robes and my horse and do just as you said and get that guy Mordecai. We need to honor him. And you could just imagine the countenance of Haman and the inward going, oh dear, what did I just do? What did I just do? Here is Haman, his enemy Mordecai, who just built a pole to impale him. Now he has to lead Mordecai. As Mordecai's on the horse, he's leading the horse through the town square and yelling and saying, this is whom the king wishes to honor, and screaming and yelling this out as he goes to the town square. Don't tell me God doesn't have a sense of humor. Don't tell me that God doesn't set things up. Just happened to be in the outer court. Just happened, the story being read to the king during this time. And so, verse 1 of chapter 7. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. And on the second occasion, while they were drinking wine, the king said to Esther, tell me what you want, Queen Esther. He knows something's up. He doesn't know what it is. His beautiful queen has risked her life to come to him, not just to have dinner. Something's up. The king is wise. Not always godly, but he's wise. Tell me what you want. What is your request? I will give it to you even if it's half the kingdom. Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request, I ask that my life and the lives of my people be spared. For my people have been sold to those who would kill, slaughter, and annihilate us. And if we had merely been sold as slaves, I could remain quiet, for that would be too trivial a matter to warrant disturbing the king. Who would do such a thing? King Xerxes demanded. Who would be so promiscuous as to touch you? Who is this? I want to know who this is who is messing with my queen. And Esther replied as she's leaning back on the couch, "This wicked Haman is your adversary and her enemy." And Haman grew pale with fright before the king and queen. Then the king jumped to his feet in a rage and went out into the palace garden. And Haman, however, stayed behind to plead for his life with Queen Esther, for he knew that the king intended to kill him. In despair, he fell on the couch where Queen Esther was reclining, just as the king was returning from the palace garden. Bad move, dude, right? And so the king exclaimed, Will he even assault the queen right here in this palace before my very eyes? And as soon as the king spoke, his attendants covered Haman's face. That's a bad sign. That means you're going to die. And Haman is stuck and impaled on the same pole which was prepared for Mordecai that day. And though the king could not take back the decree that was made, he made another decree. And that decree was, anyone who touches the Jews will be dealt with. And as you read on in the book of Esther, there is a time and period where there is 500 men who attack and they are killed by the Jews. In fact, Haman had 10 sons and they all were impaled as well. See, that's some rough stuff. Here's the thing. Sin always affects other people around you. And Haman's sin did as well. You see, how does this relate to us? We read about Queen Esther. None of us here are queens. None of us here are kings. None of us here are gatekeepers like Mordecai for a king. But this is what I know as we look at this, is that our unforeseen hardships are not mistakes. They are God's setups. Think about this. Esther had lost her parents. I mean, she basically is an orphan that has to be adopted by her older cousin, Mordecai. She wasn't in her homeland. She was brought over during a time that, her parents or grandparents were brought over during the time of the Babylonian Empire that attacked and took all those out of Judea. It didn't seem that she had much choice in marrying the king, though it seemed that she did love the king. You know, there's one thing that I love during this time. I love ice cream, but one thing that goes well with ice cream is brownies. Especially when you microwave those brownies just a little bit. You know what I'm saying? And the ice cream gets a little melty. I like my ice cream just a little melty. Now, some of y'all are like my wife. You just like to gobble up your ice cream and not enjoy it. Something spiritually is wrong with you. And God still loves you, but there's something wrong with you. You got to enjoy that ice cream, right? And one thing, I love brownies with it. But the interesting thing with making brownies is you have the ingredients. The ingredients by themselves are not all that great. The ingredients of having flour, the raw egg, the vanilla, are not tasteful by themselves. But once you put all of that together, once you put the chocolate chips in there and you put some of the caramel or caramel, whatever you want to call it, is as good, right? And you mix it all together. You can throw some marshmallows in there a little bit. And man, you just get some wonderful, wonderful brownies. You get something that you enjoy. And in our lives, we need to be careful. We need to be careful that instead of blaming God for everything, instead of blaming others for everything, even at times blaming the devil, some of the things that we get ourselves into, there will be times in your life that you're going to go through a time that God is putting in essential ingredients that taste like flour. They taste like raw egg. And you may be confused and you may wonder if God even knows your name, if you even have the favor of God. The fact is, instead of blaming the devil, instead of blaming other people, maybe take a step back and go, what is God doing? What is God getting ready to mix up? What is God getting ready to throw into the oven? Because when God gets cooking, it's going to get hot. Amen? It's going to get heated up a little bit. It's going to make you a little, sometimes a lot, uncomfortable. And so, in your time, right now, Just as Mordecai challenged Esther and said, Esther, there's no mistake that you are a Jewish girl who is now the king. You are an orphan and you are chosen. There was no question that God had shown you favor. There's no question that God had made you beautiful and smart and intelligent. And God has made you the queen over the superpower of the world. God has chosen you for such a time as this. And if you don't do it, Esther, God, he's God. He will find another way to get it done. God will get the job done with you or without you. I want you to know here this morning, there's no mistake God has placed you where he's placed you. It's no mistake of the family that you were born into, good or bad. Whether you love your family, hate your family, like your family, whatever. God placed you in that family. He placed you in the town, in the country. He placed you in the United States. He placed you where you're at for such a time as this. It's no mistake the job that you have. It's no mistake of the spouse that you have, the children that you have or even don't have. And that can be hard. And that can be rough. And you can wonder. I know for my wife and I, we were done at 2. I had my wife convinced, we are done. I'm like, all right, no more diapers. Thank you, Jesus. Praise God. And things happen, right? And my wife got pregnant, and a couple months into the pregnancy, my wife had a miscarriage. And so we were hurt, of course. And that one was a surprise. So we have a little one in heaven. And my wife, I want another one. I'm like, oh, all right. So Grant was planned, all right? Don't tell me he was a mistake. He was planned. But we wouldn't have little Grant today if we did not have to deal with some of that flour and that raw egg. And you see God, he starts to mix it up. God was like, you may be done having kiddos, but I'm not done with you having kiddos. There can be so many different things like that in our life, the unforeseen things which God has for us. So for such a time as this, God has made you, he has called you, and he has given you a purpose. And you may be struggling with your purpose right now. But preacher, I know I'm a child of God. I know I'm saved. But we struggle with our purpose at times, don't we? Sometimes because we're in a season, a different season which we were in before, and things have changed and we get uncomfortable. We wonder, what is God doing in my life? He has a purpose. He has a purpose for the season which you're in. And I want you to know, your life is not a mistake. You have a calling and a purpose. Proverbs tells us this, Proverbs 20, verse 5. It says, the purposes of a person's heart are deep waters, but one who has insight draws them out. And all people are made in the image of God. Each of us are born with a purpose and a calling. We are wired a certain way. God made you the way he made you. You may look around at other people and go, man, no one else is really like me. You may be a little bit of an odd duck, like Mitch. We love Mitch, right? All right? There's not a whole lot of people like Mitch. Mitch is Mitch. You always need Mitches around. Amen? I'm just picking on Mitch because I know he can take it. But God made you just the way he made you. He wired the way he wired you for a reason. We find peace and we find courage when we sense the confirmation of the Spirit that we are in the right place at the right time of our designated calling. And Esther's reaction, I love it. It wasn't, well, yes, I am queen. Her reaction was, we need to pray. We need to not just pray. We need to fast and pray for 3 days. In fact, I can't do it by myself. Mordecai, I need you and I need our people to fast and to pray. And so I know that I'm doing what the Lord wants. And if I die, I must die. She was willing to lay down her life for the purpose which God had given her. And though she didn't know it completely, let me ask, have you prayed about it? And not just prayed, have you prayed and fasted about what you're going through? When I lived in Marietta, one thing I noticed was a lack of community. You have 900,000 people in one county. And yet, it was probably for people, the number one thing people dealt with, and I believe this is true even here, maybe in Florence, and people in our life, is despite all the social media that we have and all the different ways we have to be connected, I believe this is the loneliest time for people today. People are lonely. You know, nothing happens by accident. And you can be lonely because a spouse has moved on to glory. You may be lonely because maybe the grandkids moved away. I don't know what your reason for loneliness could be. It could be that you're surrounded by your loved ones, but yet you still feel so lonely inside. I don't know what it could be for you necessarily here this morning. But as we see and we read about the life of Esther, we see that God had everything worked out and planned out, even though she didn't see it all at the time. So in your loneliness, what should I do, preacher? What should I do? Pray and fast and see what God does. See how God moves. See who he brings into your life. See where ways in which you can get connected for God to move in your life, because he never leaves us nor forsakes us. Albert Einstein said this. He says, a coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And Esther has chosen to be the queen. She's in a unique position to help her people. I mean, Haman sharpening that post to impale Mordecai, and the same night that the king is reminded, he could have gave the decree, the word to Haman. Yeah, go ahead and kill Mordecai without knowing that even his queen and Mordecai were even related. He didn't know it at the time. He didn't find that out until afterward. There's no coincidence. God is in control. But I want you to know something. Trusting God, just as Esther did, is key to your story. Trusting God will mean that you have to have courage in the midst of fear. Trusting God may mean that you lose something momentarily. Trusting God may take you out. It will take you out at some point in time, out of your comfort zone. God never promised you would always be comfortable. Has it been a while since you've been uncomfortable? God may just be getting ready to shake things up in your life. If you're uncomfortable, if you're comfortable, are you really in the game? Are you really in the battle? Because we are in a spiritual battle every single day. See, life for a while was not comfortable for Esther and Mordecai, but they decided they were going to trust God and have faith regardless. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, great passage. Trust in the Lord with all thy heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. The key is acknowledging him. And that's exactly what Esther did. She acknowledged the Lord. She wanted to hear from God. She wanted to see what God wanted her to do. If there's a saying that applies even more so to Esther and Mordecai, is when Eisenhower said, evil prevails when good men do nothing. And they knew. They were willing to take a stand and do what was right. You see, anyone can just go with the flow. Anyone, including the dead. But a man or woman of God will stand in the gap. Will you stand in the gap? Will you trust in God and trust that God has a better story? Trust that God is not done with your story. That God's timing is greater than yours. You see, he has a better story. The question is, will you trust God for it? Let's pray. Father.
Thank you for listening to today's sermon. To find out more about Southside Baptist and our ministry, visit our website, southsidenow.church. Until we meet again, have a great week.